taping, if they can go ahead and start taping, if you will. We started yesterday on 10 values that a psychiatrist who was head of psychiatry at the University of Wisconsin Medical School felt were essential issues or questions that people have to deal with if they're striving towards maturity. And yesterday we spent a lot of time on love and self-love. And obviously we're not going to finish all 10 because tomorrow I think it'll be the last time I'll be here. And I'll meet at, I think, at 10:30 in the sunroom if you're interested in the community building, in the village center. That's where it's in the sunroom at 10:30. But anyway, the second value, which I just mentioned this very briefly because, and then I'll hand you the paper. But the second value that Halleck says that we need to deal with, he says, is an openness to experience. He said, a maturing person will be open to new experiences. Now, he says this is within the context of your present responsibilities. And I think he's saying here that certainly a cultured person is not open to experience of committing murder or committing adultery or committing rape or anything like that. But short of these basic responsibilities we have, he says, a person cannot be fully aware of the world unless they have some capacity to understand the manner in which they perceive that world. And I think, Jim, what you have said in your lectures hits this so well, because you're saying art ought to be a window towards openness of experience. And I think one of the tragedies of life, certainly of my life, was when I was growing up in a fairly traditional type home, traditional concepts of religion, was that I would not question anything. I wouldn't be open to new experiences. I remember, Nietzsche to me was always a total anathema, because this was a bad man who knocked the Christian religion. And here I am 70 years old, and all of a sudden I discovered Nietzsche, and it just opened up a new world to me. And I said, my gosh, all of these years that I've spent without drinking from the cup that man had to offer. Not everything he says is acceptable, but I mean, there's so much there. So I think Halleck is right that we must be willing to face the new, that's the reason I challenged you this morning, you know. It's a very subjective kind of thing that one must even explore that which one does not like. There may be something there for you. But anyway, anytime you have any need to interrupt to ask questions, please do so. Today, I want to primarily probably spend time with the fourth point primarily, but certainly we'll discuss the third point to some extent. The third point, Halleck says, the third value is the ability to find an optimum amount of freedom. Although human beings need to love others and rely on others if they are to survive, they must also be able to experience their distinctiveness. Again, this ties in so much to what you said this morning, Jim. I think that too much in our society, people are worried about what their neighbors think. People are worried about what somebody else thinks about them. We go through life maybe evaluating ourselves by what feedback we get from others, and that's just such a totally self-defeating kind of a process. And I made some notes here because I feel that, as I said yesterday, one must love oneself, and without self-love, it's totally impossible to really get past the first base in life. This is the essential thing, and I have a wonderful quotation, if I can find it, distinguishing between selfishness and self-love. These are two entirely different things. And somewhere in here in these notes, here it is. This helped me to distinguish between selfishness and self-love. And this is from Eric Fromm in his Escape from Freedom. Selfishness is not identical with self-love, but it's very opposite. Selfishness is one kind of greediness. Like all greediness, it contains an insatiability, as a consequence of which there is never any real satisfaction. Greed is a bottomless pit which exhausts the person in an endless effort to satisfy the need without ever reaching satisfaction. The selfish person is always anxiously concerned with himself, He is never satisfied. He's always restless, always driven by the fear of not getting enough, of missing something, of being deprived of something. He's filled with a burning envy of anyone who might have more. This type of person is basically not fond of himself at all, but deeply dislikes himself. Selfishness is rooted in this very lack of fondness for oneself. Narcissism, like selfishness, is an overcompensation for the basic lack of self-love. He loves neither others nor himself. And self-love is exactly the opposite. It is not a running away from anything. It is not being greedy, but you recognize yourself as a unique, individual human being who deserves to be here, who has a value to be here. I remember, what is that? There's some hymn that we used to sing where you compare yourself to a worm. Which one is that? It's one of the big hymns of the church. Well, I'm not a worm. I mean, I used to sing it, and I say, yeah, I'm no good, and I grovel before God, and I've committed this and then that sin. And until one loves oneself and deals with God's grace, whatever that may mean to one, it's just impossible to experience your distinctiveness, your uniqueness, that you have a place in this world, and you don't compare yourself to others, but you're uniquely you. Any questions on that? That seems to me so self-explanatory. It is difficult to achieve, and I think last session we gave some reasons to why people have such a hard time loving themselves. I like to deal with a fourth point, which one of my favorite points. Because humans are the only animals who are physically and psychologically helpless for a large part of their young lives, they have to learn to rely on structure and authority as a prerequisite for comfort. Now listen to this. Whatever tendency they might have to outgrow this need is thwarted by the appreciation of the imminence of their own death. Humans are the only beings who comprehend their own mortality, and they cannot live with this knowledge without belief in some power that transcends their own. In other words, what he's suggesting here is that we live as totally dependent beings for years and years and years. I mean, it takes the human child 15, 17, 18 years to stand on his own 2 feet or her own 2 feet. And we're dependent on our parents, we're dependent on the school system, dependent on Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, whatever it is that, you know, we're involved in. And then maybe about the time that we feel that we are not dependent, Halleck says, and I think he's very right here, we realize deeply in our subconscious mind that we're going to die. The realization of death comes early in life. You can see it when somebody dies and there is a child, a 15, 16-year-old child in the family that's involved in the death. And you can see the fear, you can see the apprehension. They know death. We know death as fairly young people. And I think that thought, that apprehension, that reality keeps rumbling around in our subconscious mind. It stays there until and unless we deal with death and accept it as a reality, then I think we're doomed to less than mature lives. We're doomed to lives of apprehension, lives of fear, lives of running away from something. Does that make any sense to you? Or is Halleck just way off? So one question I like to ask when I hold, and I do this in the business world when we talk about values, and I'm not afraid at all to bring up issues like that when I hold seminars, used to hold seminars. At what moment does the resurrection become effective? At what moment in life does the resurrection take on significance and meaning and purpose? When does it happen?
When you yourself are free.
When you yourself are free. Okay. Any other?
What do you think? I can remember a time in my life when that metaphor, the resurrection, was the only metaphor that really talked to me about what I had experienced.
Yeah.
As I had an experience that was extremely powerful, and that on the other side of it, the metaphor of death and resurrection said to me exactly what I had experienced. And it was then that the symbol of the resurrection, yeah, and the metaphor a great power for me.
Yeah.
Of, beyond the sort of abstract stuff that I've learned as a child.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What do you think most people say when you ask them, when does the resurrection become effective? What do you think most people will say?
After death.
Yeah. They associate resurrection with death, and resurrection becomes effective when they die or after they die or whatever. And this, of course, is a great tragedy that I think most people in our society, including many, many church-going people, have precisely that image of resurrection. And I take my place alongside of Jim that resurrection, to be meaningful, has to be effective today. I mean, this is the day in which you're resurrected. In order to overcome one's apprehension about death, now I'm very careful to distinguish between death and dying. I think to have a some apprehension about a slow, lingering, painful, agonizing death, I think that's something most people do not welcome, and that the process may be unpleasant, to say the least. But dying is not death. I mean, dying is a process. Death itself is something entirely different. I mean, that's when a new life begins, and I think that resurrection is now. It's today. It's precisely when we're confronted with the poem that you read, one of the poems you read this morning, dealt with that issue. That then you're liberated. You see, when you know that you've been resurrected, when you know this, there's no fear. There's nothing that can bind you. There's nothing that can hold you. That's when you, in my opinion, my experience, you become an individual. What's there to be afraid of? And tell the bishop to go to hell. That's what you really feel like doing, because he's been acting like a two-bit so-and-so. I mean, that's when you're not tied down to the materialism. So what if you don't drive a Cadillac? So what if you don't live in a house, you know, a five-bedroom house in the suburbs? So what if this, that, and the other thing? You're not living in this dimension. You're not tied down to this timepiece that we wear on our wristwatch. I mean, we wear on our wrist. We're not tied down to what we see and what we smell and what we taste, but we're liberated. We live in another dimension. This is the great thing about having faith. Whatever this dimension is, heaven, I don't know what it's like. I mean, pearly gates, golden streets, you know. Well, if they're golden streets, you better issue me a pair of arch supports. I can't think of anything more uncomfortable than walking on golden streets. But, you know, if that's with it, it's fine. If they're angels with heavenly harps fluttering around, playing celestial hallelujahs continuously, I mean, that's fine. And if it's something entirely different, totally beyond my comprehension, what the heck difference does it make? But you're liberated from this limiting life that is so fleeting and so temporary, and for most people, most of the time, until they're resurrected, fairly miserable, because they're dealing with the temporal things, and the temporal things never are sufficient. It's just like this quotation I read about selfishness from. Like Fromm says, without resurrection, you become so preoccupied to fill your days and your times with material things, so you know you're alive. I know I'm alive when I water ski, you know, and get a new jet ski, whatever it may be, you know. Your aliveness is predicated upon the here and the now, instead of being immersed and absorbed in the larger scheme of an eternal kind of a creation. And I shared this illustration this last week, but I don't think any of you have heard it. There's a, to distinguish between the chronometer, the chronos, the time that is set by the revolution of the earth around the sun and the four seasons and all that, and 24 hours a day, we all have to live by that. I mean, I'd be foolish to say if we didn't, but we have to live by that. But that's just one dimension of time. There is the other dimension which began at creation, or Big Bang, you know, whatever it is, and we'll keep on keeping on. And there is this beautiful story from the Norse Eddas, which is the Nordic scriptures, the Nordic religion, the Norse religion, I should say, where it says that there is a rock, and the rock is 1,000 miles high and 1,000 miles wide and 1,000 miles deep. So you got 1,000 cubic mile of rock. And once every 1,000 years, a little sparrow comes to sharpen its beak. You got that image? Little sparrow sharpening its beak. When thus, through the erosive action of a little sparrow sharpening its beak on 1,000 cubic miles of rock, when thus that rock shall have been worn away, one fleeting moment of eternity shall have lapsed. Now, when you have that kind of imagery of time, and you're in that time frame as a human being, you're not going to sweat it. I don't care what it is. You know. Now, there's some uncomfortable things that happen to us in life. Okay, I know that. There's death of loved ones, and there is disappointment with your children, and there is pain, you're sick, and you know, and horrible pain, and you don't get the promotion you're looking for, and you don't get the job that you really want, and you're not happy doing computer drawings because it takes so long before the customer buys them or whatever it is. I mean, this is life, and that's, you know, that's part of the bargain. But if you put that into the context that you're really participating in this eternity, I like that thing on the boat. I've mentioned this to several people. When we came out here, we came out in a slow boat, where the little kitchen is, where you get your sandwiches. There are the signs, the rules of the Lady of the Lake, or whatever it's called.
Lady Two.
Huh?
The Lady Two.
Lady Two. Okay. Rule number one, don't sweat the little things. Rule number two, all things in life are little. And then I'm interpolating, I'm throwing one in word because it really makes fun to me if I say, except number three, frying bacon in the nude. I just think that's funny. It just, you know, puts things into perspective for you. And I know that life on this world is meaningful and significant, and we have to work hard at it, and we have to do the best we know how to do, and I have to put in honest to goodness, you know, 10-hour day to do my thing, or 12 hours or 8 hours or whatever it happens to be. But there is a dimension beyond this dimension, and that's resurrection. You know, and look what we do in the Christian church. If you're not baptized by immersion, my Southern Baptist friend would say, you're not going to go to heaven. Oh, gosh, my Church of Christ folks. But if you're not immersed by a Church of Christ, and you belong to Church of Christ, you're not going to go to heaven. You know, it's God who made the infinity of space. That petty? I mean, if he's that petty, I don't want to be around him. I have no use for it. I don't want to be around a God who worries about whether I was dunked under, or whether I had water sprinkled, or whether I got any water on me at all. I don't want to mess around with a God who is that narrow and that small and that proscribing in life. I want a big God. At least a God who is as big as I am. I want a God smaller than that. There's a book that was written when I was, you know, back in the 50s. I think it was by Phillips. Your God is Too Small. Remember that one? Am I right? Phillips write it?
I think you're right.
Yeah, J.B. Phillips. Your God is too small. This God we're worshiping is a humongous God who doesn't have time for all this petty stuff that church laws and church ordinances have ordained. I'm a rebel. Okay, so what? If God can't handle me, may the Lord have mercy on him. That's all I can say. Surely he can handle me. And this is just a big thing. I like this quotation from Abraham Maslow. Now, you know, he's a Jew, but so what? The confrontation with death and the reprieve from it makes everything, he went through some episode where he almost died, makes everything look so precious, so sacred, so beautiful, that I feel more strong than ever the impulse to love it, to embrace it, and to let myself be overwhelmed by it. My river has never looked so beautiful. Death and its ever-present possibility makes love, passionate love, more possible. I wonder if we could love passionately, if ecstasy would be possible, if we knew that we'd never die. Isn't that beautiful?
Yeah.
You see, if I know that I'm swallowed up in this big time frame, I can really turn loose and I can smell the roses along the way. And if instead of roses there's darkness, sweat it. Sweat it out. Don't worry about it. It's going to be absorbed. And it's so sad. But I mean, death in America is just, you know, we're so neurotic. We're just so neurotic about death in America. I remember when I pastored a small church, and church in a small country town, the undertaker and I were pretty good buddies. And he finished a new chapel, you know, redecorated, remodeled, and all that sort of thing. And so he asked me to come up and look at it. It was really nice. And we stood there in the front and he says, John, I want to show you something. I want to show you something. And he said, look up there. Well, there above the place where the casket would be at the time of funeral were several light bulbs. And notice they were all different colors. One was a pale blue and one was a pale purple and one was a pale something or other. And kind of a tricky kind of an outfit. And I looked at it and he said, you know, when that light falls on the corpse looks lifelike. And I thought to myself, just, you know, how neurotic can we get that in death we want to look lifelike? And I turned to him and I said, well, I guess the biggest compliment for you is when the family says he or she looks so lifelike. Denying death when we're facing it. And all this money we spend on. I know families who spend more money on funerals than they've ever spent on a vacation in their lifetime. Now, what, you know, what is that? What are we trying to do? Well, part of it is guilt. You know, you absolve yourself from guilt when you give your mommy or daddy a big funeral. I mean, that's part of it. But part of it is just this, we've never dealt with it. Death is a topic we don't discuss in America. And we die in a sterile environment. We let people die, you know, in the hospital. And they don't die at home, and the family isn't around. And the doctors and nurses take over, and the undertaker takes over, and we are not involved in it. So we're removed, and because we're removed, we're afraid, and we could talk about it. We have this totally neurotic attitude towards it. And all this time in the background of our minds, we know we're going to die, we know we're going to die, but we won't face it. So we run away from it. I think this is partly behind a big health problem that we have in America. I mean, the cost of medical care problem that we have.
Sure.
I'm sure by now all of you know that, and the figures I've seen, it goes anywhere from 48 to 60% in the articles that I've read, and I've read some fairly good studies on this thing. A minimum of 48 up to a possibility of 60% of all medical costs in the United States are spent on prolonging the last 30 days of a person's life. Now, that ain't sick. I mean sick up here. And I don't know what it is. Why can't we let old people die gracefully without being hooked up to 15,000 machines?
I'm from Michigan, and I'm really anxious for you to get to the next one. Dr. Kevorkian.
Oh, well.
I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, I mean, I was...
So relevant to...
Yeah, I...
Here's
the answer. Hemlock Society. I'm a member of it. Now, the Hemlock Society has some problem with Dr. Kevorkian. I don't personally, because they think that maybe Dr. Kevorkian acts too fast, too soon. And Hemlock, being a political organization, in a sense, does not want to be any further out than it already is. But yes, I mean, when I have reached the end of my life and the pain becomes unbearable, why shouldn't I be granted the privilege of having a doctor put whatever it is into my vein? Instead of lying there and the cash register keeps on ringing.
I started hoping for heroin at that point, since it's addictive, the addiction doesn't make any difference, and you can just sort of glide off on the cloud. British hospices.
Yeah. I tell you an experience that started me off on the physician-assisted right to die. And so help me, Hannah. This is what happened. I had this lady in my congregation in Dallas who was cancer and, you know, end of life. Now, she was not a senior citizen. I mean, I don't know how old she was, but 55. I mean, you know, some was a lot. She was not up in years like that. But there was no question in anybody's mind that she was going to die fairly soon. And she was in agony, absolute physical agony. And I waited for the doctor. I did not know this doctor. And I said, for heaven's sakes, doctor, can't you give Mrs. So-and-so more pain medication so she won't suffer so much? And he said, oh, no. And he said this in dead seriousness. I'm afraid she might become addicted. I said, my God.
Does this matter?
Yeah, what kind of an answer is that? I mean, here's a woman dying and he worries about it. But so neurotic are we about some people about this drug business, you see, that they would not give her enough medication.
Or was he worried about a lawsuit?
Well, back then, this was back in the middle 60s when malpractice suits were tough to come by. I don't think he was, now today, yes, but I mean then, and you see, my position is this, that, you know, if you don't want to have physician-assisted suicide, if that's your choice, fine, I'm not going to force it on you, but I ought to have the right to have it done for me. We had a Senate, state senator in Texas, Gonzalez, Catholic, would never even think about right to die, but one of his best friends, and maybe his best friend, I don't know, had a terminal disease, I don't know what it was, but it was horrible kind of a thing. And the guy committed suicide with a gun, and that's a nasty suicide. And Senator Gonzalez introduced legislation for physician-assisted suicide in the state of Texas. Now, I'd never got out of committee, but I said, boy, I mean, this is so, I'm right now organizing a Hemlock chapter, trying to, in Austin, so we can support the senator and what he's doing. No, I think it's far more graceful to die with a physician when you reach that stage of life or the end of your life than to go through some of the stuff that I've seen. Now, I think when a person is young, I had a daughter-in-law who was 37 or 38 who had cancer of the breast and metastasized. And, at that age, I say, pull out all the stops, you know. I mean, 38 years of age, you keep on hoping against hope, and you're fighting for life, and she hasn't, you know, lived her life. And yes, I mean, do what you can. But my gosh, you get to be 70, I'm 70 myself, so, why? When it gets to that stage. Yeah, I'm all for it. Not for Dr. Kevorkian, even at young, you know, people have some of these, like Lou Gehrig's disease. I mean, that's a horrible disease. I've only known one person who had it in my pastoral life. I've only known one person, but it's a horrible way to die. I mean, it really is a horrible way to die. And if the person says, I've had it, you know, and it's not just a one-time statement, but I mean, it gets repeated over and over again. I can't face this anymore. And I want to die, and this is repeated over and over again. Why not be gracious and allow that? I mean, if you're living in eternity, what difference does it make whether you live another month or so? But about this medical problem, it's not on this point at all, but this was the best statement I've ever heard on our medical delivery system. It said that in every other industrialized nation, medical delivery is a service. In America, it's a commodity.
Yeah. Yeah.
And boy, that says it, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
In a nutshell. Yeah. Until we get that out of commodity into service, I don't think we'll have a solution for it.
That's why the argument around pro-life, particularly in relation to this issue, is so hypocritical.
Yeah.
It just simply is not really the issue people are concerned about.
Well, I mean, all these pro-lifers and all these people just want to impose their morality on everybody else. And today it's abortion and it's, not permitting physician suicide. And tomorrow it'll be the books that you read. It's just a natural consequence. These things, if you think this radical movement's going to stop with the right to life issue, you're nuts. I mean, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to say that, but you are. It's going to keep on keeping on. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
I highly recommend you join the Hemlock Society and support us in this venture. And then I say, what does our attitude about these issues say today about our own faith, you see? I've never understood how a person can be a devout Christian and be afraid to die. You can be afraid about the process of dying, okay? I mean, that I'm totally empathetic with. Because I think I'd be that way myself if I'd get cancer. You know, I don't cherish that idea particularly. But if one is afraid of death, I mean, what does this say about your faith?
And the expression of fear on his face, and that did it.
Oh, is that so? I had not heard that. So the Vatican insists that you have this radiant faith, huh?
Yeah.
That's interesting. I hadn't heard that before, yeah. Denied sainthood because he was had this wrong expression on his face. Wow. Well,
their undertakers just weren't skilled in those days.
In our society, that's what we would say, isn't it? Okay. I guess I have this other question here, which probably really goes to the previous paragraph, but it ties here. What does it say about our faith if we do not allow other people to experience their distinctiveness, to let them be different from the way we are? What are we afraid of, you know? We may not like it, that's not the issue. But what are we afraid of if people have radically... What's there to be afraid of an atheist? You know, Christians go all bonkers when there's an atheist, and the word is meant... So what? Well, I mean, what is there to get all upset about, you see? There are far more important issues than that. And I may stray here a little bit. I just got this is new thinking in my mind, and it was stimulated by something I read very recently. It deals with culture. Now, this is a Freudian idea. This came out of Freud's writing. That doesn't make it bad, ipso facto. Freud proposes that culture is a social contract in which you contract away certain instinctive drives that you have in order to benefit from a social or cultural milieu. And he says there are three, and I have not done any reading, so please, you know, don't hold me on this one. But he says there are three instinctive drives, three instincts that have to be compromised. An individual has to surrender and deal with if there is to be any culture at all. And these are the three. The first one is cannibalism. Now, I do not know. I have done absolutely no study. And that's one thing when I get back, sweetie, I'm going to study about. I mean, what is the genesis of cannibalism? We know it exists because people driven to extreme positions like the Donner Party, well, this thing down, this airplane wreck down in South America a few years ago, people will turn to cannibalism. But Freud says there are three things that you have to give up in order to have culture: cannibalism, incest, and murder. These are the first three things that you have to surrender. Well, my thinking is that we have given up by and large cannibalism. I don't know anybody, you know, who would be cannibalistic except in a totally dire circumstance, and the person may become that, because there's evidence that that has happened. So maybe this is an instinct that we have been able to bury and compromise for the sake of culture. Incest? We obviously have not compromised incest. I mean, there are too many cases that we read about, and we know for every case that we read about, there are 100 cases that are not reported. And murder? I don't know how it is in your town, but it's bad in our town. So do we even have the basis for a culture in our society when we have not compromised or voluntarily managed two of the three drives that Freud thinks are absolutely essential for culture? And then we wonder why we have the savings and loan scandal, why we have people ripping off their stockholders, why we have executives, drawing huge bonuses when the company doesn't make any money. We haven't even dealt with two of the three basics to have a culture. So, what is it, you know, I mean, this is something completely besides what I've read here, but it's just something that the distinctiveness we have to, and we're so afraid to let people be distinctive. Nixon getting an FBI file and everybody who during the 60s, you know, was a hippie.
Yes.
I've got a son who went to Duke, and, you know, he smoked pot, you know, all these things that hippies did. He's got an FBI file. Not a bad guy. I mean, you know, he didn't do anything that warrants the attention of the FBI. He was different. There were a bunch of other kids. Has now turned into a respectable doctor, you know, does all the things that supposedly, quote-unquote, respected people do. But why can't we let people be distinctive? And there's a beautiful Johnny Cash song. No, not Johnny Cash. It is a Johnny Cash song about how we sweat the length of a person's hair and the color of his skin and the dress that they wear. Why do we sweat it? Now, it's Johnny Cash before conversion. After he got converted, he hasn't written a decent song as far as I'm concerned. He's like, you're familiar with Botticelli. It's interesting. Botticelli painted all of his great paintings before Savonarola got a hold of him. Huh. Savonarola was an evangelical Catholic who predicted the end of the world and called everybody to repentance in the year 1000. And so Botticelli got scared and he got converted. Did not paint a great painting after he was converted. I don't know what this is. I'm not against conversion. I'm against that kind of conversion. But we're so afraid of people being different from the way we are. And you can't be maturing if you're that. Okay, any questions on that? Well, let's go on to the next one, if we may. Gosh, maybe between today and tomorrow we'll get all of them in. That'll be great. Let me give you number 5. I think there are enough copies here for all of you. Yeah, this is another, boy, this is another great one. Okay, Halleck says, humans also have an innate need to interact with their environment and alter it in a manner which provides them with a sense of mastery. They may find it in daily work, in organized play, or in efforts to create new art, music, or literature. What is important is that everyone must to some extent be active and must experience his activity as either having an impact on other people or as having the capacity to alter one's physical surrounding. He is simply saying that human beings are made to be creative. They need to interact with their surroundings, with their fellow human beings. That we're social beings, we are not hermits. We have this need to do something to give expression to our selfhood. Now, for most of us, this is found in our work. That's where most people interact with their environment. The 8 best hours of the day belong to your boss. If you're a housewife, the 8 best hours of the day belong to you, you know, taking care of the kids and doing the housework, and that's the thing that most of us do. Now, there are artists who, you know, have more freedom, if you will, in that sense, and yet, so I asked the question when I had my business seminars. You know, it's amazing. Some of the big corporations I worked for would want me to discuss, they would actually pay me, which was great, but also give the employees time off for me to go through these points with them. This was really, I really was surprised at that, but I had any number of clients who allowed me to do this, and so I rejoiced in that. And I would ask these people who are working 8 hours a day, and I would say, what's the first word that comes to your mind when I mention the word work? And what do you think most of them should say?
Stress.
Hmm?
Stress.
Stress was a very prevalent one. What's another word? Another word was money. In other words, they work to make money so they could go out and support themselves. Labor was a very frequently mentioned word. Labor in the sense of laboring. And I said, yeah, but isn't that sad? Isn't that sad? And yet, when one reads this quotation from Stutz Terkel's book that I have on here next, one can readily understand it. Terkel wrote a book some years ago that he called Working, and he just went around and interviewed hundreds and hundreds of laboring people. And by that, I mean people who were in factories, you know, hourly wages, secretaries, bookkeepers, people working in fast food services, you know, once put your hamburgers together. All kinds of the laboring people of America, the people who make America work. They didn't interview the, he interviewed some supervisors, but he did not go into management. But he went down to, you know, where the work is done, the garbage collectors. That's where the work is done. And this is the introduction to his book. This book, being about work, is, by its very nature, about violence to the spirit as well as to the body. It is about ulcers as well as accidents, about shouting matches as well as fistfights, about nervous breakdowns as well as kicking the dog around. It is above all or beneath all about daily humiliations to survive the day's triumph enough for the walking wounded among the great many of us. Now that's a horrible indictment by a fairly respected and responsible author. This is not John Brand talking. This is someone who has standing and stature in our society. How can Halleck's concern about people having a need to creatively interact with the environment be fulfilled when our workplace in all too many cases looks like what he described here? Is there any wonder that there's alcoholism, drug abuse, divorce, all of these things that, you know, are breaking down our society if labor is not held on a high level where people see their investment in themselves as being a venue of interacting with our environment? And so little is done by most corporations, most companies, to make people feel good about their jobs. And it takes so little to do it. It takes so little to make a person feel good about his or her job. The last job I held was such a thrill. I was hired by this company that I'd consulted with to run everything except the engineering and the finance and all the technical aspects of an oil and gas company, which meant primarily human resources and motivation and training and a lot of other things. But these were my main concerns. And by developing a simple system of allowing everybody to have what I call their sandbox to play in. Mm-hmm. You know, here's a bookkeeper. Well, what difference does it make how he or she adds up the figures, or in what order they do it, or how they arrange it, as long as the output is there? Why worry about job description going to the nitty-picky of just tying a person down and making them feel he's a cog in a machine? So here's what we need to have done, and we negotiated these things with people. I mean, you know, what needs to be done, and let them decide how it's to be done, as long as the output was there. We didn't care if they came to work at 8 o'clock or at 9 o'clock, if they left at 4 or at 5. The supervisor set the output. And if you were gung-ho, you know, and people said, well, you can't run a company that way. And I said, well, maybe not. Maybe I can. Fortunately, the owner of the company was behind me 100%. And we, you know, somebody has sickness in the family and they got to take their kid to the doctor. Okay. And there never was a time when these people didn't make up their work. Didn't happen. But we treated them as human beings. We paid them well. But people are totally amazed. We did over $2 billion a year, which is a lot of money for a little company. I never had more than 125 people in the office. And that included our presidents. We had five companies in our organization. And all of the, you know, the owners and the five presidents and the vice presidents and all the deadwood, as I called it. I mean, we did the work with about 110 people. Tremendous amount of work to be done in an oil and gas company. Yes, ma'am.
Did you have some people who couldn't function in that kind of atmosphere?
We had the only persons who left our company was one lady, the 5 years that I was with them, well, seven because I consulted them for 2 years before that, was a lady whose husband was transferred someplace. And a young man got a job that we could not, in the foreseeable future, I couldn't give him the opportunities that he had with his other company. Never had anybody, I had to fire one person. That's in 7 years.
But there are some people who could not.
Well, let me tell you how this works. You see, we use some really, and this is not on the subject, but it deals with, yes, it is on the subject. People are different, okay? And we use the fairly sophisticated psychometric instrument to find out what makes people tick. So, for instance, I would have one bookkeeper who would have, well, the test would, or the evaluation would indicate that he would have a need for structure. Okay, a person has a need for structure. Yes, you can't turn them loose like that. You can't do that. So you sit down with this person, but you don't tell him, Joe, this is the way we want it done. No, you don't do that. You say, Joe, now here's the job, and what is your idea on getting it done? And then your supervisor works with him on getting the structure organized so he can secure the structure. If a person, bookkeeper just in the next office, had a need for freedom from structure, all we need to do with that person is to say, look, this is what we'd like to have done. This is, you know, let's work with this thing for a little while. And if you got any questions, come to me and ask me. So we dealt with people as individuals. There are some people who had a need, psychologically have a need for individual approval. Well, you butter up these people. I mean, I say this, you pat them on the back. He's doing a good job. Oh, wonderful. Happy for you, you know. You let them know you're glad. You say good morning to them. We had a wonderful president, just a wonderful president, and Jack was into all this thing, and he'd go through the office and, you know, and then he'd pat him on the back, and what does it do to a person? The president comes by and says, how are things going? And he really means it. He looks at you. Anything I can do for you? On the other hand, you've got some people who've got psychologically a need for straightforward, direct relationships. Well, these are the people. You tell them how the cow eats the cabbage. They'll love it. Person need for individual approval would absolutely go bonkers. But a straightforward person just absolutely loves it if you tell them, this is what I want you to do. You're screwing up on this job for me. Oh, am I? What am I doing wrong? That's what you're doing wrong. That's great. Okay, chief, I'll do it right. You use that approach to the person need for individual approval, you lost him. So we're very careful to know where our people are coming from, psychologically, behaviorally. Now, we were very demanding, you see, but we were demanding without putting the squeeze on them. I dare say that our people did 125 to 150% of the work that other people did in similar companies. They worked their buns off. We paid them well. I had an office boy, made $18,000 a year. His salary was 12. He had a bonus at $6,000, possibility for a $6,000 bonus. He knew going in at the beginning of the year what he had to do to earn an extra $6,000. Listed, it was spelled out. So what happened? I had two office boys doing the work of three or four. I could afford to pay high salaries. I had bookkeepers making $24,000. This was back in the 70s. Bookkeepers making $24,000 a year. Base salary, adequate, heck of a bonus. And they all knew the company had to make money for them to earn the bonus. They all knew that. But we treated people like individuals. And that's what pays off. We had no problem with alcoholism. We had no problem with... We went through this stress period. Didn't have a single heart attack among my executives, among anybody for that matter. It's amazing when you treat people like human beings. So they can do what Halleck says is absolutely essential in a maturing person, that people have a need to interact with their environment. It makes them, gives them a sense of mastery. Gives them a sense that I'm in charge of my life. And he may be an office boy, but if he's in charge of his functions, and you give him an opportunity for advancement, if we paid their education, if they got A's, we paid it 100%, they got B's, we paid it 90%, C's 80, anything below C, sorry, you're out of luck, we're not going to pay you. You have to deal with people as human beings. But in most businesses, people are what? Marx was right. I mean, you know, too bad we don't study Marx. In our system, human beings are increments of the economic productive pie. And you can't have maturity and self-realization in that that type of an environment. And what we have, you know, I'm scared to death about what's going to happen in America with the economic uncertainty. Whenever there's economic uncertainty, bosses and managers feel they can do anything to human beings that they want to, because people are going to work hard. If I'm afraid to lose my job and I've got a mortgage and a couple of kids at home and a wife to support, I'm not going to say anything critical. I'm not going to dare to oppose you. I don't care how you rate me. I'm going to say yes, sir, because I want that check at the end of the week. That's tragic. Because then I go home and I feel I've been raped all day, and I will act like it. My pain is there, my suffering is there, and I will act on that pain, and I will act on that suffering, and that's destructive. Not only self-destructive, destructive to society. You know, I think capitalism is dead. It just doesn't know it. Dead in the daughter. It's as dead as communism will ever be. And it's not the system. They're not wrong with communism, they're not wrong with capitalism, nothing wrong with any ism. Is there? They all find, I mean, you read it black and white. It sounds great. You read Karl Marx, wow, it's great stuff. You read the great precepts of the Social Democrats, of the Weimar Republic in Germany, that's great stuff. You read Adams, Wealth of, what is it?
Adam Smith.
Yeah, Adam Smith. Wealth of Nation, is that what is it? Yeah, Wealth of Nation. It's great stuff. Who louses it up? We do, human beings. Human beings, not the system. It's Stalin who messed up the system. What Stalin did wasn't communism, right? But we've got America now is not capitalism. It just isn't. It's opportunistic materialism, I call it. Thorsten Veblen calls it conspicuous consumption. We get our ego trip by having a bigger house than the guy next door. And this eats you up because it isn't life. It isn't life. It's not living in the eternity. It's living a miserable kind of an existence. I ask question, you know, if how does love of self and the understanding of time help one to survive in a dead-end job or a job in an abusive supervisor? It's a very real question a lot of people have to ask. And does their faith enable them to transcend the environment? It can happen. I had I did a lot of work for Southwestern Bell in Dallas. And I had this lady in one of my seminars. My seminars were basically based on psychometric data with self-analysis and how to handle stress as you strain, that sort of thing. There was this lady who had a tremendous need for freedom, you know, just to do her own thing. And she was a telephone operator back in the days. You remember the switchboards, those huge oak boards? They sit there and they plug in all day long. They plug in these things, you know, and that's all they did all day long, 8 hours a day. And she came to me after the seminar and she said, John, he said, I've read this about myself, and you're so right. I need this freedom, and when I don't have it, you know, I just become self-destructive. And I said, I quit my job, and I go to the nearest bar, and I pick up any man I can find. And he said, I'm ashamed of myself. I wasn't reared that way, and I've done this for years, and I escape from my job. I said, what can I do? Well, it was not possible for her to get another job. Had no qualifications. You know, she's done this all of her life, and very limited education, and somewhat limited person in terms of capabilities. And so we talked, and I said, well, and I said, can you, you know, when you're on a switchboard, I said, do you ever talk to people that have problems and you have to help them? And she said, oh, every day, every day. And I said, well, can't you somehow concentrate on those and say that if it weren't for me, that person would not get the right answer? And sometimes there'd be emergencies every once in a while, and there'd be exciting things. And I said, the more you concentrate that you are a person who, even though you're looking at the stupid switchboard, and even though 80% or 90% of your daily life is taken up with putting those stupid plugs into the right hole, I said, there are times in your day when nobody except you can do what you're doing provide a good answer. I said, think about that for a little while. I didn't think I'd done very well with her. But she came back a few days later, and next time I had seminar, and she said, you know, I started thinking about that, and a couple of things happened. She told me some kid was trying to find his mother or something, I don't know. And she said, it makes a difference how I feel about things. And I said, yeah. And this quotation from changing the attitudes of your mind can change the outer circumstances of life, William James, that I used yesterday. It began to work on her. And she quit all this bar hopping, and she went back to school, and never did anything else except do that switchboard. But she found some self-esteem by going to junior college and taking some courses in art. I don't know what she did, but it changed her life through the inner attitude of her own mind. Now, I'd say that's an unusual case, but it can happen. And I sometimes, you know, cringe when I see the suffering in the world and our church is being preoccupied with little pietistic stuff. When there's such bleeding out there that needs the grace, I mean really the grace, helping people to come to grips with themselves so they can go on towards maturity and respect themselves. Question, comment? I thought you were saying. I'm sorry. Okay, well, you've been a wonderful group. If you're around tomorrow, I'll be holding forth at 10:30, I think it is, at the room down there at the Village Center. Thank you for coming.
Great. Tomorrow's your last time.
Yeah, tomorrow's our last time. We're going to leave Thursday, yeah.